This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. It's time to go ahead and tell you about it. I've been teasing it for weeks now. Now, let me explain, first of all, how this new little red book of mine came to be. You remember that I wrote with my buddy Nick Rizzuto, we wrote the Anti-Communist Manifesto. I'm not an author. I don't intend to write any more books. I've told you that before. It was a subject I was passionate about. What are we facing today? How do we combat it? What are the action items? What do we do? Not just complaining, what do we do? I wanted all that in one book. We wrote the book, national bestseller, we couldn't believe it. People actually liked it. You liked it, we liked that. I didn't want to write another book. I wanted to write another chapter for the Anti-Communist Manifesto. That's really how all this came to be. I wanted to write another chapter. Me, Nick, we sat down and we just started writing stuff out. And I guess this probably happens to people. It kept growing and growing and growing. And soon it was more than a chapter. There'd be a new story, or I'd have a new thought or something like that. And so eventually we ended up with what was obviously going to be a little mini book, a booklet, if you will. And we thought, well, let's just make it a booklet. And I didn't want to sell it. I'm not selling you anything. It's not a gimmick. I'm not pulling some fast one on you. We just thought it would be good for everyone to know what we're up against, why we're up against it. So we came up with my little red book. Mao Zedong had his little red book. We'll talk to Stephen Mosier about that in a few minutes. That Mao's little red book was used to rally the communist masses in China to purge good people and some bad people, of course. That's obviously not my intention for our little red book. I wanted something easily consumable that I could just give to people. That's what we wanted. Go to jessekelly.com, put in your email address, and we're going to send it to you. I'm not going to ask for your credit card info. I don't even want your money. I'm not trying to sell you a thing. We'd just send it to you. So many people are already emailing the show because they had previously gone to jessekelly.com and put in the email address, and they all woke up this morning and there it was, right there in their email. That's it. It's just, we wanted you to have it. We have to understand what we're up against, not just in this country, but worldwide. And we can't discount the Chinese aspect to what we're up against and how much they have influence in our country over, frankly, both political parties, but they own the Democrat Party now. Remember how often Joe Biden talked about how he and Xi were besties?
Fact is that I have met with Xi Jinping more than any other world leader has. I've had over 68 hours of private meetings, just he and I, with simultaneous interpreters.
I spent a lot of time with Xi Jinping when I was vice president and subsequent to that. And he once asked me in the Tibetan Plateau, could I define America for him? And I mean it sincerely, not a joke. I said, yes, one word, possibilities.
I've allegedly met more face-to-face with Xi Jinping than any world leader has.
America is a nation that can be defined in a single word. I was in the foothills of the Himalayas with Xi Jinping.
They're here. They're here. They're highly invested in this country. They're invested in our university system. Communism is not just spread to Americans by other Americans. It's not just spread by your daughter's liberal college professor. It's not just spread on TikTok and Instagram. Communism is here, and China wants it here. China does everything it can to ensure we are kind to the most demonic religion in the history of mankind, communism. The Federal Bureau of Investigation did everything it could to ignore China's efforts to manipulate the election and instead told you it was Russia.
The intelligence community's consensus is that Russia continues to try to influence our elections, primarily through what we would call malign foreign influence. But we certainly have seen very active efforts by the Russians to influence our election in 2020 through what I would call more the malign foreign influence side of things. Social media, use of proxies, state media, online journals, et cetera, an effort to both sow divisiveness and discord. And I think the intelligence community has assessed this publicly, to primarily to denigrate Vice President Biden.
But that was all a lie, because even the FBI is in on it. So, what are we dealing with here? How about Democrats? How about the useless Republicans? I even have ideas on life and food and goofy stuff in there. I just wanted it all condensed in a little book that I wanted to send out for free. So jessekelly.com, go put in your email address and enjoy. Stephen Mosier is an expert on China, and we'll talk to him next. What have you been snacking on? Be honest. Please be honest about it. Look, it was cold yesterday here in Houston. Nobody was out and about. Everyone was closing businesses. You know what I did? I snacked. Oh, I snacked. But I had massa chips. Not only were they delicious little hot sauce on my massa chips, I can eat them guilt-free. I don't even have to risk getting the side eye from the wife, because it's just natural stuff. No seed oil filth, none of that. Just beef tallow, salt, corn, the crunch. They are the crunchiest. They're the best thing in the world. Try some massa chips. They even have a dessert chips like churro, but I like the lime ones a lot. Big fan of the lime. They have habanero, just regular chips. MassaChips.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Mao, China, what happened there? How did we get to a place where now our number one geopolitical foe is building a lot of ships, doing a lot of saber rattling? Well, let's talk to someone who's forgotten more about the place than I will ever know. Stephen Mosier has an incredible book out, The Devil and Communist China. You really want to learn about this place? I would highly recommend you go pick that up. All right, Stephen, before we get to China, let's talk about you first, because I know we're about to have a long talk here. Who are you? How'd you learn all this stuff?
Well, I was, as it turns out, the first American social scientist allowed to spend a full year in China under our U.S.-China Scholarly Exchange Program. This was a long time ago, Jesse. I was there in 1979 and 1980. We had normalized diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. Jimmy Carter did that. And of course, through Taiwan and the dustbin of history, at least he thought that. And so I was on the ground in China in March of 1979. I had been at Stanford University. I was teaching at the University of California at Berkeley. And I thought it was a great honor to be the first American allowed to really take a look, an extended look, a year-long look at what was happening in China behind the bamboo curtain. You know, China had been closed to us for 30 years from the revolution to 1979. Now it was open. It was a great opportunity to see what life was like on the ground after 30 years of communism. And as you, as we will talk about, it was not a pretty picture. But that's my background. I was selected by the National Security Council, the Social Science Research Council, the National Science Foundation to be the first guy on the ground in China. I can speak, read, and write Chinese. That's why they selected me. And boy, I think they got more than they bargained for when I came back and told them about all the human rights abuses that I had discovered. I was actually accused at one point of jeopardizing U.S.-China relations by my reports on human rights violations in China. And I thought to myself, actually, I said publicly, if what I say about China, which is the truth, is jeopardizing U.S.-China relations, then maybe they need to be jeopardized. Maybe they shouldn't be as important as we were thinking about them until very recently.
Stephen, I can't wait till we get to that part of it, but let's actually rewind before Mao, because a lot of people know Communist China now, and they've obviously heard the name Mao Zedong, but what was China before that? Because he didn't come into power until 1949, but what were they before that? What happened?
Well, China has a long history, of course, but let's start after the fall of the Manchu Dynasty in 1911-1912. That was what we call now the Qing Dynasty. It was a dynasty lasted almost 300 years where the foreigners, the Manchus from Manchuria, came in, conquered China, and were ruling the Chinese. That was overthrown. And China set up in the teens of the last century a republic under Sun Yat-sen. They had a constitution that was modeled on the U.S. Constitution. And in fact, you know, 160 of the 180 constitutions in the world today draw on the U.S. Constitution. People don't know that because they aren't taught that. But so China had a constitution modeled on the U.S. Constitution. It had a federal system of government. After Sun Yat-sen passed away, the new leader was Chiang Kai-shek. And Chiang Kai-shek was a Christian. He became a Christian when he married Song Mei-ling, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, and he was a devout Christian. Actually, you can read his diaries that he wrote later in life, and he quotes scripture and he prays. So the ancient dream of, you know, Matteo Ricci and the early missionaries that China would convert, that the emperor would convert to Christianity, and the people of China would follow, and China would be part of become part of Western civilization, seemed on the cusp of being fulfilled finally after centuries. And then what happened, of course, at the same time that democracy and freedom were spreading in China, we had this other evil cult, this other evil ideology, this satanic cult called communism, arise in the Soviet Union, and they quickly thought to spread it to China. And so Mao Zedong, one of the early founders of the Chinese Communist Party, from the very beginning was getting support, monetary transfers, and advisors from the Soviet Union to help carry out his revolution. And so for the next two decades, in the 30s and 40s, these two very different philosophies, one of respecting human rights and limited government and a democratic republic, fighting against a one-party dictatorship, a tyranny where people were reduced to mere cogs in a machine. They were fighting each other. And sadly, towards the end of that conflict, we, the United States, chose the wrong side. We stopped supporting the Christian General Chiang Kai-shek. We stopped sending arms and support to the nationalists. And the Soviet Union kept sending arms and support to the communists, who gradually overwhelmed the nationalists and drove them out of China and to the island of Taiwan. That's what happened in history. And it's a sad thing for the Chinese people that this took place, because had Chiang Kai-shek won the Civil War, had we supported him as we should have, hundreds of millions of Chinese would be alive today. China would be a free country. They would have regular elections. They would look a lot like Taiwan does, which has now been a fully functioning democracy for many, many decades. They would be free, they would be prosperous, and they would be, together with the United States, a force for good in the world. Unfortunately, that didn't happen because of communism. The forces of darkness, rather than the forces of light, won in China and took China to a very dark place, and are now attempting to take the world to that same dark place.
Stephen, can you elaborate, I hate to drill down on this detail, but why we stopped supporting Chiang Kai-shek? Why, when we were so interested, allegedly, in making sure other countries didn't fall to communism, why would we all of a sudden withhold critical support to the group that would have been an ally?
Well, remember, we're talking about World War II and the end of World War II with the surrender of Japan. We wanted peace to come to the world. And we had been told by people in the State Department who were sympathizers with Mao Zedong and the communist Chinese that they really weren't communist. Now, they were merely agrarian reformers. They simply wanted to take the land away from people who owned too much and give it to people who owned too little. And once they finished that, everything would be fine. Mao Zedong capitalized on that. He took advantage of leftists like Edgar Snow, who came to his capital, Mao's capital, Yan'an in North China, and wrote a book called Red Star Over China, in which he portrayed Chairman Mao as some sort of wonderful character who would bring goodness and light to China. All of that was a fabrication, but most of the correspondents in China at the time of the Chinese Civil War were admirers of the Soviet Union. They were on the side of the communists in the Spanish Civil War, for example. And so their reports came back to China, came back from China to the U.S., combined with the reports that the people, leftists in the State Department, were giving the Truman administration. And Truman thought, okay, well, since these guys are simply agrarian reformers, and since we're hearing from the New York Times some bad things about the nationalists and Chiang Kai-shek, let's make them work together. I'll send General Marshall to China, and I'll have him negotiate a peace between the communists and the nationalists, and they can share power, and the war will end. Well, that was a pipe dream. Obviously, Chairman Mao was never going to share power with anyone, but he took advantage of the 18-month forced truce. And how was it forced? It was forced because Marshall suspended arms shipments to Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Army. They weren't getting any arms, they weren't getting any ammunition, they weren't getting any funding from the United States of America. They were cut off from their principal support in the midst of a civil war, while the communists in Manchuria, the Red Armies, were being armed with every weapon that had been taken from the Japanese at the end of World War II in Manchuria. All of the tanks and howitzers, the river gunboats, the planes, everything that the Northern Japanese Army, the Imperial Army in Manchuria had, was turned over by the Soviet Union to the communist troops. And all of a sudden, you know, it wasn't just, guns and millet, as Chairman Mao said. He said he conquered China using guns and millet. It was howitzers and advanced weaponry from the Japanese. And so they were getting constant support. We had withdrawn our support, and the nationalists were forced backward and finally forced off the mainland altogether. That's how we lost China. And because we lost China, due to the leftists, the communists in the State Department, and the misunderstanding of President Truman of the real situation on the ground in China, the world has been a much less safe place ever since, especially for the Chinese people themselves, because, you know, the primary characteristic of communism is mass murder. Communism, you know, the idea that man can create his own heaven on earth, is quite simply the most deadly idea that has ever been conceived in the history of the world. Once this communist faith came to power in China, you know, it killed more people than any war, famine, or pestilence in Chinese history. It's killed hundreds of millions of Chinese, sadly. But that's how it came about. When I was teaching a course in Chinese history at the University of California, Berkeley, I actually had as one of my students, this was 1978, one of the people in the U.S. Foreign Service who had been stationed in Yan'an with Chairman Mao, and he had written back all these wonderful reports to the State Department talking about how they were so idealistic, and there was no there were no killing, there were no purges, there were no persecutions, everything was sweetness and light. He compared in his reports life in Yan'an to kind of life in a Christian summer camp. Everyone was on the same page, everyone was marching happily into a brave new world. What he didn't know, because it was kept from him, was that a few miles away, there was a prison camp, where prisoners who disagreed with marching bravely into the brave new world were tortured and struggled and killed and executed and brainwashed. That was the other thing the Chinese Communist Party invented in the 1930s. That's where we get the term brainwashing. It comes from the Chinese xinao, which literally means wash brain. And that is what you do when you put someone in a tiny cubicle and you subject him to morning to night study sessions until he finally breaks down mentally and says, as Winston does at the end of Orwell's Brave New 1984, I'll say whatever you want me to say. If you hold up three fingers and want me to say four fingers, I'll say four fingers. I'll say anything that you want me to say. That's brainwashing. You turn people into your servile minions, people who will obey without thinking anything you tell them to do, up to brutalizing and killing other people. So brainwashing. All that went on in Yan'an, and it was kept from the American visitors, kept from the American correspondents, and a lot of Americans got the wrong idea about what communism was like. Chairman Mao did his best to reinforce that story. He wrote a number of things in the late 1940s during the Civil War about how he wanted to put in place a new democracy, how his new democracy would respect human rights and religious freedom, freedom of thought, and so forth. All of that was nonsense. All of that was propaganda intended to do one thing, and that is weaken the support of the West for the nationalist and strengthen support for his own communist revolution. And because of this propaganda warfare, he was able to win the Chinese Civil War. That's why Mao often said, and Xi Jinping today, the current ruler of China, often says too, quoting Mao, he said that I have three magic weapons that I use to conquer China and that I use to stay in power. They are propaganda, united front tactics, and the People's Liberation Army. In other words, propaganda comes first. If you can control the minds, the thoughts of people, you don't need to rely on other subversive tactics like the United Front tactics of taking over organizations and creating false organizations like the so-called Catholic Patriotic Church. And you certainly don't need the men with the bullets because you've already controlled the people through their minds and they serve you voluntarily, not out of fear. So it was propaganda, United Front tactics, and the People's Liberation Army. And they used propaganda very effectively on the United States in the Chinese Civil War. And that's one of the principal reasons that they won the Chinese Civil War. And again, put in place this tyrannical system, which has now lasted over three quarters of a century. But thankfully seems to be approaching an end of some kind.
Stephen, Mao wins the Civil War. What's the great leap forward? What's he do first?
Well, the first thing he does throughout China's 2 million villages is he sends in his communist cadres, and he tells the people there, the poor people, the landless peasants, the people who just have a little bit of land but need to rent more, he tells them that they're going to benefit from the revolution because he's going to carry out a land reform. He's going to take land away from people who own it and give it to people who don't have land. And so he organizes, the communist cadres organize in the villages the worst elements of the village, the people who don't work very hard, so they don't have very much. And they're told that if they join the Communist Revolution, if they join the Peasants' Association, they can then have everything they want because it'll be taken away from those who have it and given to those who don't. And so in every village in China, there was a land reform carried out. The landlords, and these were people who had, you think landlord, you think 1,000 acres. No, these were people who had more land than they could farm themselves. They had maybe 5 acres. They had 10 acres of rice paddy, something like that. They weren't huge estates. The landlords were put up on the stage and accused of all kinds of crimes, of exploiting the poor, of stealing from the poor, ill-gotten gains of all kinds. They were tortured, brutalized, and killed. And then their possessions, their land and everything they owned, was then given to the poor people who had tortured and killed them. And that went on until the landlords were either all killed or had committed suicide. And the promise was, of the land reform, was now you have your own land. But communism is deceptive from the beginning. And this too was a deception, because the Communist Party never intended to let the people in China who were given land keep that land. No, the plan was always to immediately collectivize. So 2 years after the landless peasants had been organized and taught how to kill the landlords and rich peasants and had been given their own land, the land was taken back by the state, which became the big landlord, owning every piece of property in China. It still does today, by the way. The Chinese Communist Party technically is the owner of all property in China. It is what the Chinese villagers called the big landlord, the Da Dizhu. And this collectivization went from 100 families farming the land in common to 1,000 families farming the land in common to, in some cases, tens of thousands of families farming the land in common in giant communes. The commune I was in, which ironically enough was called Equality Commune, Junan Gongsha, Equality Commune had 80,000 people living in the commune. And who was running the commune? Well, not the people themselves. The communist cadres were running the commune. And of course, they were sitting behind their desk and holding meetings and eating at banquets, eating very well, and always looked much better nourished than ordinary people. Ordinary peasants would be lean. Communist Party cadres always carried around a few extra pounds because they were living off the fat of the land. They were living off the hard work, the sweat, blood, and tears of the peasants. So the collectives were formed. The Great Leap Forward in 1958, we're going to force everybody into giant collectives, collectivize everyone. Mao wanted to destroy individuality. Communism always wants to destroy the individual and replace it with this amorphous concept of the masses, right? We're all part of the masses. Individuals aren't important anymore. Individuals aren't important anymore. It's all about the masses, the collective. So these people were forced in these giant collectives. And again, it was bait and switch. It was deception by the Communist Party, because the peasants joined the giant communes, didn't really have any choice. If they didn't want to join, they were killed. And they were told, don't worry, you'll have free food from now on. Just farm the fields as the communist cadres tell you to. Work from dawn to dusk, following their orders, and we will feed you and take care of you forever. And just to make sure that you don't get the idea that you can pick a few vegetables from a tiny garden plot and cook them in your own kitchen, we're going to take away your kitchen cooking pot so you won't be able to cook in your own kitchens anyway. Well, that went on for about a year after the commune started. And then the food ran out. Because guess what? The Communist Party cadres had no idea what they were doing. They had no idea when to plant, when to harvest, when to fertilize. People weren't working very hard. Surprise, surprise, surprise. The fields didn't belong to them. There was no sense of ownership. And so they went out late in the morning and came in as early in the afternoon as they could get away with it. The food ran out. And then the Communist Party cadres said, now it's time for you all to go home and eat out of your own kitchens. Well, they didn't have any kitchens anymore. They didn't have any woks. They didn't have any pots. That had been taken away. But they were all sent home to do what? To starve. And 45 million people starved to death in 1960 and 1961. 45 million people. The worst famine in human history, Jesse. Not caused by drought, not caused by flood, not caused by natural disaster. Caused by Chairman Mao, who forced everyone into these giant communes. And once the communes failed, sent them home to starve. Now, he didn't starve, and his cadres didn't starve. The people in the cities had to tighten their belts. In some cases, they were eating, you know, pretty lean meals for a long time. The men with the guns, the People's Liberation Army, they didn't starve. But the peasants, the hundreds of millions of peasants, starved to death in large numbers. They were literally eating the bark off trees. I interviewed people who were catching mice to eat, and they were happy if they caught one mouse a week. They were stripping the bark off trees and eating the bark off trees to try to stay alive with a little bit of nourishment they could get from that. They were boiling weeds and eating weeds, eating grass, trying to get some nutrition out of that. There are entire villages that no longer exist because every living soul in the village starved to death during the Great Leap Forward. And you know what the kicker is to that? This man-made famine, the worst famine in human history, caused by communism, caused by Chairman Mao. The kicker is that word of the famine got out of China, of course, through Hong Kong, because starving refugees were coming across the border to Hong Kong saying things are really bad in China, we're starving to death. And the United States offered to send grain to China. Now, we didn't like communism even then. I mean, this was 1960. We were already in the midst of a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and China was the Soviet Union's ally. But we are a generous and good country. And so we responded to the reports of tens of millions of people starving to death with an offer of grain. So did Canada. And Chairman Mao refused the offer of grain because he said there's no famine in China. Well, he wasn't going hungry, to be sure, but there certainly was famine in China. So that's the story of the Great Leap Forward and the death of 45 million people. There was a grave outside the large village that I was living in Equality Commune, where 200 people were buried, mostly the very old and the very young, who had died in that one village during the famine. That famine has not been forgotten in China today. People remember the famine as they remember the Cultural Revolution. And that's why they often keep a little extra food stored in their homes. And that's why they hang on to any extra cash they get, because they're afraid that another famine could be coming to China. China, even today, can't feed itself. It has to import grain. It has to import soybeans and corn and other things from the United States and other countries. And things may get so bad in China again that there's another famine. Watch out.
All right. Time out right there. We have so much more with Stephen Mosier coming up in just a minute. You know what's wild about sleeping well is that when you sleep well, it compounds. You know, it works the same way when you're not sleeping well. You don't sleep well one night, and then you don't sleep as good. But when you start taking dream powder from Beam every single night, you put together 8 hours, and then 8 hours, and then 8 hours, and 8 hours. It's like you're not even the same person after about a week of that. Do you struggle sleeping? I know there's a pill bottle out there. I know the pharmacy has a million things for you. Why don't you focus on natural things? Why don't you have a cup of hot chocolate before bed? Dream powder from Beam. I have the chocolate cinnamon. It's delicious. I sip on a cup of hot chocolate before bed, and then about a half hour later, I just go drift off to sleep. And when I wake up, I don't feel that groggy heaviness. I'm ready to go. Do it for a week. You'll never stop. Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. Stephen, tell me about this Cultural Revolution and Mao's Little Red Book. What was the Little Red Book? What kind of brutality surrounded the Little Red Book? Tell me about all this.
Well, Mao had a very good grasp on human nature, how to actually deform human nature and undermine human nature, especially among the young. Remember that, I know you know that Vladimir Ilyich Lenin said, you know, give me the young people to educate, and in 3 years I will make them into good communists. Well, Chairman Mao understood as a committed communist, Marxist, Leninist, the importance of education. And so he always focused, even from the beginning of his revolution, on the young. That's why we have reports from the very early base camps in the 1930s set up by the communists of children turning on their parents, during the land reform of children accusing their own parents of exploiting workers and being landlords and rich peasants and getting them killed. That's why we have reports during these other purges of family members turning on each other. It was the young. He was very good at manipulating the young. And I think we see that in leftist movements everywhere today, even in our own country. So what he did in the Cultural Revolution, the 45 million people who died in the Great Leap Forward famine, there were a lot of people, even in the ranks of the Chinese Communist Party, that knew that this was a Mao-caused disaster. Liu Shaoqi, the premier, the second-ranking guy in China, tried to take power away from Mao in the early 1960s. They told the peasants, you can have your own little garden plots. We're not going to force you to farm the collective fields exclusively. We'll give you a little garden plot, maybe 50 feet by 50 feet, and you can grow your own vegetables there. They wanted to prevent another famine. They were taking Mao away from the front line. He complained at the time. He said, they're moving me back to the second line. He couldn't tolerate that because he wanted to be, as a paranoid megalomaniac, he wanted to be in absolute control. And so what he did was he put together, out of his writings, and he wrote, you know, volumes of books over the decades, he put together quotations from Chairman Mao that became the Little Red Book. And he organized something called the Red Guards. He asked all the students in the country to read his Little Red Book and follow him, because there was a new revolution was needed. The old revolution was stalling, was failing. And so we needed a new revolution to get rid of the four olds, everything old, everything foreign, everything Confucian, everything from the nationalist period. That all had to go. Of course, what that was a purge of his political enemies. People like Liu Shaoqi, the premier, and the generals who had opposed him after the disastrous Great Leap Forward, all those people were arrested by the Red Guards, and the same thing happened to them that happened to the landlords 15 years ago. They were put on stages. They were publicly struggled. They were called struggle sessions, and they were accused of all kinds of crimes. They were literally spat upon, beaten with sticks, stabbed with knives, stoned in some cases, and of course they were ultimately killed. The Red Guards soon began to fight among themselves, and there were actually major conflicts in different Chinese provinces between different groups of Red Guards, each of whom claimed to be the authentic bearers of Mao Zedong's message. They would shout. They began by shouting slogans from the Little Red Book at each other, and pretty soon they were shooting guns at each other if they could get their hands on guns. There are actually graveyards in China today filled with the corpses of Red Guards who were killed during the conflicts. It was an amazing time. But the whole Red Guard movement, the whole Cultural Revolution movement, was in one sense, again, a strategic deception by Mao. By claiming to be fighting against the four olds, by fighting against feudalism and Confucianism and anything foreign and foreign religions, you know, all of the churches were destroyed during that time. Even the churches that had said, okay, we acknowledge the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, just let us continue to read the Bible and preach the gospel. Even those churches who had gone along with the Chinese Communist Party, they were destroyed by the Red Guards. But that was all a cover story for what Mao was really about. And what he was really about was purging his enemies, getting rid of them, using the Red Guard as his stooges to torture and kill his enemies. And by the end of the Cultural Revolution, he was absolutely alone, again, at the top of the power pyramid, because the leading generals, and of course the former premier, and even Deng Xiaoping had been sent into exile. And so he was, by 1975, he was alone in calling the shots, supported by his wife, Jiang Qing, and a couple of the other new Red Guard Politburo members. And then he died in 1976, and Deng Xiaoping came back out of exile. But that's what the Cultural Revolution was all about, this tremendous upheaval, which caused the loss of millions of lives, the traumatization of the entire population of China, the destruction of much of its cultural heritage, was all about a power struggle in the top ranks of the Chinese Communist Party. And we see that again today. I mean, we've got Xi Jinping deposing generals left, right, and center. And because why? Because he wants to stand alone at the top of the power pyramid. He is a 21st century version of 20th century Mao Zedong. And he's the same kind of personality that always rises to the top of, you know, this bitter factional fighting, this deceit and deception, this infighting always allows the people who rise to the top of such a structure aren't nice guys. They're like the scum that rises to the top of a stagnant pond. You always get the worst of the worst, the ones who are the best at backstabbing, at deceiving, at strategic manipulation and deception. And that's what we have today in Xi Jinping, and that's what we had in Mao Zedong, who I believe is one of the most evil creatures who ever existed in human history, certainly by the number of people that he killed.
Did he love watching people die? I've read things that Mao loved to watch torture. Mao loved to watch the death of his enemies. Is that just propaganda, or is that true?
Well, in the beginning, when Mao betrayed his communist colleagues during what was called the Autumn Harvest Uprising, he was supposed to attack a city and take over the city and create a base in the city for the Communist Party. Instead, he took his thousands of troops that he had been given command of and went up in the mountains and set up a red base called at Jinggangshan and the Jinggang Mountains. And he had his thousands of troops there in the mountains, and he was the little emperor on top of the mountain. The Communist Party leaders were in Shanghai, several hundred miles away. They were furious at Mao for hijacking the troops. And on two occasions, they actually kicked him out of the party and sent people to tell him that he was being kicked out of the party. The people who arrived in Jinggang Mountains to tell the little emperor Mao that he had been kicked out of the party didn't live very long, as you can imagine. So Mao was always a master of deceit and deception from the very beginning of his reign, when he actually stole the troops away from the Chinese Communist Party and set up his own little kingdom.
Go read Stephen Mosher's book. It's fascinating. Stephen, I cannot thank you enough. That was wonderful. Appreciate you, sir. All right. Maybe do a little book reading next. You have high interest debt. I'm talking 20s, 30s. Look, if you do, first of all, put that shame away. That's a very common tale now. High interest debt. I've got all this high interest debt. But do you own a home? You know that American Financing, they're here for you. We're talking rates as low as the fives right now. Why don't you dump those 20, 30% interest rates and just get a hold of American Financing and find out what they can do for you? You don't need this soul-sucking nightmare of high interest debt. American Financing is here, but they can't help you unless you give them a phone call. 866-891-2821, or you can go to AmericanFinancing.net/Jesse. Give them a call. 20-30% is bonkers. As low as the fives, make a phone call. All right? All right. I told you my little red book is not just all political stuff. There's also some basic life advice in there. Here's a little tidbit. You ever see these videos of people going out on Instagram and swimming in floodwaters whenever the streets flooded? Yeah, here it is. Quote, do not swim in floodwaters. Floodwaters are poop water. That's a really, really important thing. I just wanted to remind you that you should never swim in floodwaters. That's sewage water. And go to jessekelly.com, put in your email address. Enjoy the book. If you like it, send it to someone else. Print it out. Carry it with you. All right? See you tomorrow.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.